I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the School for Dumb Women, the podcast where we investigate the things you're too proud to admit you know nothing about. I'm your host woman, a charming care package left at your door, Hannah Varrell. With me is bacterial overload, Alexandra Haddo.
I've been viral since before you were born, Hannah.
And social distancing queen, Caroline O'Donoghue.
I was holding you all at arm's length anyway, mostly because I'm afraid of getting nicked again.
This week we're learning about the wife of an American president, why Madame Tussaud was such a waxy bitch, and how to be hot in a pandemic. Let's start the show!
Hannah, you're looking shiny and not quite like yourself, but I would pay £15 to stand next to you and have my picture taken. What's going on?
That's good to know. Does that mean that I can invoice you for previous pictures taken?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, we've all got to make our way somehow.
Now that, freelance revenue streams are dwindling hard.
Now feels like the ideal time to just call in stray debts, I think.
Exactly. Yes.
I was doing a virtual Trivial Pursuit game with my friends the other day, because that's how cool I am.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And a question came up about Madame Tussauds. And I was like, oh God, yeah. Like the more I think about this pandemic, the more I'm like, oh, that thing's also in the pandemic. That person's also in the pandemic. Everyone is. And then I was like, yeah, Madame Tussauds is just quiet, I guess, at the moment. I'm like, what are all the waxworks doing?
Oh my
doing?
God, that is such a creepy thought. Just like they're all just standing there in the dark, like Kylie Minogue just waiting to get her picture taken, you know?
Yeah, just waiting, just getting like dusty and yeah.
Oh my God, that is so goosebumps. I love it. I wonder as well, because the weather's been so warm recently, if they have like temperature control in there.
Oh, I mean, surely.
Yeah. Well, otherwise, it's just like a candle museum. I don't know how Madame Tussauds, I don't know how Madame Tussauds isn't quiet every day of the year, because I find it the most baffling tourist attraction. I've never been, I've got no desire to go, nothing.
It's so weird, isn't it? Yeah. I have been, but it's one of those things that I think I went to with my French exchange in year 9, and no one really had a nice time.
Yeah, it's a funny old concept, isn't it? Because like, the weird thing is that like places like Madame Tussauds and like wax museums in general as like attractions kind of exist to another world where like we didn't have cameras with us all the time. So like even if, like it's like the thing is now if somebody does like run into a celebrity, you take a picture with them and there it is. And it's actually not that impressive when someone has a picture with a famous person. Whereas like 10 years ago to have a picture with someone who might look like they were, or 20 years ago who might look like they were famous, was kind of more of a guess. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, but it got me all thinking about who Madame Tussaud was. And oh my God, she's had an interesting life. Well, I say she has had. She's dead. She's very much dead.
Spoiler, she's dead.
Yeah. I think you must have had something happen to you to think, I know what I'll put my name to.
I know, yeah. Well, okay, so let me take you through her biography. She was born in Strasbourg in France in 1761, and her father died before she was born, very sad. When she was 6, her mother decided to move them both to Bern, which is in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. I've been there. It was quite nice. It was quite plain.
Lovely.
You love shitty European cities where no one's been.
I remember buying beer in McDonald's there. So that was exciting.
Ooh, that is exciting.
Yeah. So they moved to Bern because her mum got a job as a live-in housekeeper for this guy called Philippe Curtius. who was a doctor, and he would do wax models. Do you see where I'm going with this? So he first started using wax to illustrate anatomy because he was a doctor, and I read somewhere that maybe he didn't like blood. Then he started doing portraits with the wax. And he got quite close to Marie and her mum, and she called him uncle. He moved to Paris to do his wax portraits because they were getting popular, and then Marie and her mum joined him.
Hannah, I'm going to interrupt you there. My nonce o-meter is flying all over the place. Sounds like a giant nonce to me.
Well, there was some kind of... There was some kind of question over whether he was actually having a little thing with her mum.
Oh.
That's a relief to me, because I thought when you said she called him uncle, I was like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I did think that. But do you know what? Like, I'll get to this later, but there's so many different biographies of this woman. Some of them have said that he was actually her uncle. You know, he was like her mum's brother. Some people have said that, yeah, her mum was in a relationship with him. I don't know. It's complicated.
Okay. So what year are we talking here? When was Madame Tussauds alive?
Oh, so they moved to Paris in 1766.
Oh, wow, that is a long while back, isn't it?
Such a long time ago, yeah.
I thought it was like a Victorian thing. I thought it would have been like 1880 or something, yeah. You know?
Yeah, no, it's proper old school, old time. So basically his waxwork became really popular in Paris. Everyone was going to see them. He started teaching Marie to do it. She was very good at it. And then she, when she was about 16 or so, she was good enough to do these waxworks on her own. And so she did like a waxwork of Rousseau, who was the philosopher, Voltaire. And then she ingratiated herself with the royal family, and she was doing waxworks of Louis the 16th's cohort.
Oh, wow. So this was like just before the revolution then?
Well, yes.
And she was giving... She's a full-on social climber.
I know, right? And she even gave the king's sister art lessons. She made these waxworks of them all sitting down to dinner. Like, it was all going swimmingly, guys. Absolutely swimmingly. And then, as Caroline pointed out, in 1789, the French Revolution came.
Oh, no.
And essentially, it was loosely about overthrowing the monarchy.
It was loosely. In sum...
In five words or less.
Yeah.
So because of her links to the royal family, Marie was arrested. And they put her in a dungeon. They shaved her head, ready to guillotine her.
Oh, my God.
And then, I know. And then apparently a few days before she was going to be executed, Curtis, who, you know, the guy, her uncle, whatever he is, found out that she had been imprisoned and basically told the revolutionaries, no, she's on our side, she's fine. And by the way, she does these waxworks with me. And she was released and employed to make wax death masks of all the aristocrats and the royalists and stuff who had been executed. So wow. She was then rummaging around in the piles of heads and like picking them out and doing waxworks of these guillotined heads.
Wait, who was commissioning these guillotined heads though? Who was commissioning the waxes, you know?
It was the revolutionaries. Because what they would do is they would display them.
Yeah, like we've killed this person, we've killed that person.
Yeah, because I don't know how practical it is to like put an actual head on a stick and keep it for ages. You could put a waxwork head on a stick, I guess.
Why the hell has this not been made into a BBC One 9 PM Sunday night drama yet?
It smacks of Keira Knightley, doesn't it?
It does.
Oh, so does.
Yeah, absolutely honks of her.
Keira Knightley in the same role she always plays.
Yeah, as a woman who carries a fan.
Yeah.
But what I found really horrible was that she made death masks, apparently, of like Marie Antoinette and King Louis, who she used to be mates with.
So weird.
Yeah, but it's maybe she just thought she was going to be killed if she didn't, you know?
Well, yeah. Like, yeah, Jesus Christ.
Well, so she says that she was forced to do it, but she might have been paid. She might have just been being paid.
She's just an opportunist, really. But,
well, yeah, maybe. I mean, if someone was going to pay you to make death masks of dead people's heads, would you... I mean, how much would you have to be paid to do that?
well, let's say the revolution against like people who make meaningless content online comes. And you guys, and you guys are guillotined. And they say to me, like, you know, you're up against the wall next, OD. And I'm like, oh, I didn't even like them. And they're like, if you didn't like them so much, why don't you write terrible poems about how much you hated them? And I would say, of course.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, the problem with me saying how much I would be paid to do this is that my sculptures would be terrible. But I think you could pay me about 500 quid and I'd do a waxwork of your head.
Yeah, fine.
Yeah.
Especially if it also meant staying alive for, you know, another couple of weeks.
Yeah.
While everyone I knew was killed around me.
It might have been the other way around. She might have fucking hated them, but they were royals. And if they said make a waxwork of whoever, then she was like, yep, yeah, okay, fine. And then, you know, Marie Antoinette's telling people to eat cake. And then she gets what's coming to her. And then Madame Tussauds like, yeah, fuck you. I'll make you
that's
mask.
True.
I love history by Alex Haddow. It's always so fruity. Yeah, fuck you.
Yeah, the BBC haven't asked me to be their history teacher as they're doing recently, but you know.
Oh, give it time.
Yeah.
So when I saw this little fact, which was that when Curtius, her uncle person, used to make people's faces, because you'd do like a plaster cast first, and then you'd make a mold of it, and then you'd pour the wax in and let the wax dry, and then you'd like paint the wax and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So when he would make them of people's faces, he'd put straws up their noses, and they'd have to kind of sit there and, you know, like breathe through their straws for a bit, which is all very jolly and funny.
Yeah.
But of course, when you're doing a guillotined head, you don't have to bother with the straws. Because they don't need to breathe. So, yeah, that kind of struck me as...
God, that doesn't sound very courteous at all.
My God.
I know. So, yeah, that's what she was doing during the revolution. And then after the revolution in 1794, Curtius died. And he left her his collection of sculptures, which, you know, it's still been, you know, really popular and everything. And then a year after that, she married this guy, this engineer called François Tussaud. Because actually her maiden name was Groschultz.
Oh.
Which I find really annoying now. I mean, I know it's not like an original thing to say, but his name is now synonymous with her work.
Yeah.
And she did all of this shit before he even turned up. And now the Tussaud family name is like all about waxworks.
Yeah. Seriously, would tourists queue up from all over the world to go to Madame... What did you say it was?
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, it just doesn't have the same ring, does it?
Maybe she married him for his name.
Yeah, well, because the thing about Tussaud is that in French it's like Tussaud, like it sounds quite nice. And in like, you know, in Britain we'll just say Tussauds. Madame Tussauds.
We'll butcher everything if we get the chance.
Yeah, yeah, we love that.
I love you as the innkeepers from Les Miserables, by the way.
My finest work.
Lovely ladies!
But so then you'd think, okay, that must be pretty much it. That's enough now. But then in 1802, she moved to England. And then she spent 36 years travelling around the UK displaying her waxworks in, like, every different city. 36 years! Blimey! Wow.
She loved fish and chips.
But did she fall in love?
Aww.
Did she fall in love?
Well, I don't know. She had this husband.
Oh, well, yeah.
Sorry, and what did he do? He was a waxer.
He was an engineer. No, he was an engineer. Yeah. So during her time travelling around the UK, she possibly was shipwrecked while on her way to Ireland and had to swim ashore.
Oh, wow.
But,
what?
Like, the thing that... interests me the most about this woman is that in 1838 she wrote these memoirs, which biographers think are just riddled with falsehoods. So, like, the shipwreck, all of the revolution stuff that we don't know whose side she was on, really. Even apparently her dad, you know, I said her dad died before she was born.
Yeah.
She said that her dad was a soldier and he died in the Seven Years' War. But it's possible as well, there is a theory that her dad was actually an executioner and just died of like something completely different. And and she told her biographers as well that she was born in Bern, which is, as I said, quite boring, but was quite well to do at the time. And Strasbourg, I guess she didn't want people to know that she was born in Strasbourg or something. So like everything that we know about her might just be totally false.
I like it.
so weird. Yeah. It's like her creations, she gives an approximation of the real thing, but never the real thing.
Exactly.
The metaphor. Yeah.
Mm, novelist for a reason, my lads.
I mean, she sounds like she was a bit of a laugh, you know?
I think she would have been, you know, people talk about like dream dinner party stuff, and I'm always a bit like, oh, Naff, come on. Like, she would be very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although Louis Theroux would be gutted for the one dinner party that he's not invited to.
Oh my God, that's so true. Everyone says Louis Theroux and everyone says David Attenborough. And I'm like,
yeah.
Lads, they would hog the table with their bullshit stories. And also, Louis Theroux is obsessed with sex workers in a way that I think is weird.
Yeah. And David Attenborough would have to make a lot of trips to the loo and you'd have to help him.
I know, I'd be annoying. Don't want to be hearing about his prostate all night, you know?
No, I'm sure he's a lovely man, but you know.
Also, like, I feel like David Attenborough, why are there no other, like, nature documentary people? It's like, give somebody else a turn. I feel like he's been quashing everybody who's come up through the ranks.
Yeah, he's killed them all.
Yeah. And also, I'm glad that we're inviting Madame Tussaud, because in Celebrity Dinner Party Questions, nobody ever picks a woman. Everyone always throws in, like, Cleopatra at the end, especially when you ask men.
Yeah, so right.
So annoying.
Yeah, she sounds fun, and I'd have her and that Russian print, like Queen Catherine or whatever that Caroline did for one episode that was just absolutely bonkers.
Oh, Catherine the Great.
Yes.
Catherine the Great.
Who shagged a horse, maybe.
Shagged a horse, maybe. And is currently being played by Helen Mirren.
Helen Mirren, yeah.
Yeah.
So she died in 1850 at the age of 89, which is crazy for 1850.
Yeah, but maybe she was actually born in, like, 1810. You never know.
Oh, that's true. That's true. And what I kind of still didn't quite understand was why people loved all of these waxworks so much, like why she was so successful. But there's a woman called Pamela Pilby, lovely name, who's written that Madame Tussaud believed she provided entertainment, artistic enlightenment, historical education, and a place of pilgrimage. And actually, she kind of thought that she was providing news to people almost, because if you think about it, like there was photography sort of, you know, at the time in theory, but it wasn't widespread by any means. And so to go somewhere where you can see the face of someone like Louis XVI or Marie Antoinette or whatever.
Yeah, of course.
Must have been like quite exciting and really unusual.
I was going to say, even now, if there was waxworks of people that you'd never been able to see a picture of, like if I could go and see, I mean, I don't know if I'd pay to go and see it, but I'd be interested to see, you know, a waxwork of Louis XVI's face, because we've never seen a photo. We've seen paintings and stuff, but if you could, if it was extremely accurate, you know, it would be exciting to see those people from history where you've never really seen them, or you feel like you
totally
haven't.
Yeah, there was also a really interesting article in The Guardian about, I feel like I say that sentence every single episode, about Madame Tussaud, and it was saying why people really enjoyed going there, and it said its appeal lay in the liberation of the observer from the normal rules of politeness. At a time when voting was extended to more working men, its newly enfranchised visitors could rant at a disliked politician or stare impersonately into the eyes of royalty.
Oh, well, yeah.
Wow.
Which I thought was quite a good point, that actually you can stare. You can stare.
So in a way, Madame Two Swords was kind of the Twitter of its day.
Yeah. It's so interesting, because it's like the democratization of like people generally, and also the democratization of like these rulers. Like they become more flesh and blood to you and less like these things that are like far away and never seen or heard from, especially only when bad things happen, you know?
Yeah,
exactly.
It's like social media, the first way.
Yeah, it really
but
is.
But it's kind of like a power thing, isn't it? Of like, you know, you could go to Madame Tussauds and see Brad Pitt, and Brad Pitt can't tell you not to take a picture with him. Brad Pitt can't be oh, sorry, I'm just going to get into my limo and like run off somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. I hate when he does that.
I can imagine when people, like dating back from her time up till now, when they get asked, you know, for their likeness to be made into a waxwork, I'd imagine you'd have a lot of pause, right, before you'd consent to it.
Yeah.
It's very, very personal thing. Like, because it's not just your face, it's like your dimensions and everything. It's quite a big thing to agree to.
Because they're so specific about it. Like, they spend a lot of time, like, measuring people and getting the hair right and getting the eyes right and everything.
Yeah, and, like, would you necessarily want people to know that you have a the size of your feet and your hands and your waist. Like, it's very... Should people know that about you, you know?
Yeah, like, I bet famous men are like, can you please just add 3 inches onto my height?
Yeah, totally.
I bet they have Tom Cruise and his, like, big
Cuban
heels.
Cuban heels.
Oh, my God, somebody should do Cuban heels.
Oh, yes.
Tom Cruise, let's get him on as a guest.
Can I just be his new wife, Alex?
Oh, yeah, why not? I've got 5 years to spare. My last question is, do they have to get the famous person's permission to make them or not?
Yeah, because they'd have to pose, wouldn't they?
They do. I think they do all have to pose for it. They have to be, like, measured and, like, have photographs taken and stuff. Apparently there's no contracts and none of them are paid to sit there and be reproduced and waxed. But I suppose it only kind of, like, it only enhances their fame, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it's exposure.
Yeah.
It's exposure.
What I find fascinating is at what point do you retire a waxwork when the person is no longer that relevant? Do you know what I mean? Like, does Sophie Ellis Bextor still have one?
Oh, Sophie Ellis Bextor is having a comeback because she's doing all of these, like, gigs from her living room. Apparently they retired Gary Barlow for a bit. And then when
Take That
came back, yeah. And they've got this big warehouse in Acton, which is in West London, where they put all the retired ones.
Wow.
Oh, no.
So Gary Barlow went to Acton for a bit and then came back.
Oh, God. That's so weird.
That's like the synonym for a celebrity dying. They went to Acton. Yeah. So that warehouse in Acton must just be like an episode of I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. It's just people vying for the comeback.
Oh, my God. Totally. Just like just Rachel Stevens in there somewhere.
Never throw them away. That's what we can learn. Even Mr. Motivator is back.
Yes.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Cool. Good for him. Good for them. Good for celebs.
He's back motivating the nation to get fit and healthy.
Isn't that kind of Joe Wicks' job now?
Yeah, well, it's Joe Wicks versus Mr. Motivator, you see.
The death match we've all been waiting for.
Exactly. And now, a message from the organisers of the Women Who Code Mixer. Sadly, this week, Women Who Code could not be held because all the white wine in the land has sadly been bought by bougie independent companies and delivered to your door in a charming rustic box. And we simply will not have a dry mixer. We did try it with red wine once, but everyone got far too intellectual and sleepy. And, like, nobody even cried. It was a disaster. Vodka made us too slutty. And, you know, don't even get started on the one that was sponsored by Special Brew. But we'll be back in the wild very soon in the new world and drinking white wine. Thank you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Caroline, you're giving us some tips about how to grow our pubes this week. Is that right?
Sorry, what?
So, see, your section is on the Bush dynasty.
Oh, Laura Bush. As yes, I know. Although, having said that, I really could give a lot of pube tips because I personally, I think I have the nicest pubes in town.
Do you?
Oh, wow.
I just know, I've just always liked that they sort of, you know, the curtains match the drapes, you know? But anyway, this this week I have been obsessed with Laura Bush, which, like, me and Alex were talking about this earlier, but, like, I always thought that both Bush wives were somehow called Barbara Bush.
Yeah. When you said you were doing Laura Bush, I assumed that was the Chelsea Clinton of the book. Like, I thought it was, like, one of the daughters. I thought it was a daughter. No idea that it was a wife.
It's so weird because, like, everyone accepts that there were two George Bushes, George Bush Sr. and George Bush Jr., and yeah. Like, but everyone's just like, ah, yes. And they were all married to Barbara. They were all hooked up to the Barbara hive.
Yeah, exactly.
So basically, I mean, I'm sure if we have American listeners, they're probably yelling at their phone right now, being like, obviously we know who Laura Bush is. But over here, the kind of the awareness of first ladies is quite a dim one, I would say.
Yeah, we don't care.
Yeah, and, like, I've always found them really fascinating as a concept because, like, in the UK, the job of a first lady, if you will, is done by the royal family. Like, all the, like, soft diplomacy, all the, like, going to charity benefits, having causes around literacy and children and stuff, and all the, like, meeting people from different, like countries and stuff, that's very much what the royals do. And in Ireland, it's what we've got a similar kind of separation in that we have our Taoiseach, who's like basically our prime minister. And then we have our president, Michael Higgins, who's like in charge of like having lovely lunches where someone reads a poem, you know?
Oh, okay. I wondered what the difference was.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure it's much more nuanced than that. But insofar as like what it's like to actually live in the country, that's what it is. But, like, the weird thing about America and, like, lots of other countries, that job is basically taken on by the wife of the US president. So, like, she basically, as Laura Bush herself was fond of saying, like, she had an electoral candidate of one man. Like, she's like, one man elected me for this job and it has no rules.
Wow, yes, yeah.
That's such a weird thing. And, like, the reason I've got into her this week is you guys might vaguely know of an author called Curtis Sittenfeld. Have you guys read her at all?
I know the name. I honestly thought she maybe wrote Friends or something. I've just seen the name and I would have thought it was a bloke as well.
So this is where like the School for Dumb Women really shows its stripes, because this is very much like a thing smart women know about is Curtis Sittenfeld. Do you know what I mean? She's like,
yeah, she's famously not smart.
No, I didn't really know who she was either. It's just like, she's kind of like the Jonathan Franzen of women. Like, she's a very smart, she's a very good novelist who's written like this 500 page novel called American Wife. She's written other novels as well. And she's got a new one coming out about Hillary Clinton. But basically this one, American Wife, it's her big book that everyone loves and smart women care about. And it's like loosely based on the life of Laura Bush. And I finally got into it during the pandemic and I'm like a third of the way in. It's really, really good. But it's one of those things where I was like, Jesus, did this really happen to this woman? And then so it's a great thing where you're constantly looking between the book and the Wikipedia page.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
I know. It's so good, isn't it? And then the thing where like you're only so far into the book and you don't want any real life spoilers and you're like, ah!
Yeah, I know. That's the thing. You don't want to be like, ah!
You're like scrolling with your hand over half the page. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally. Well, and obviously in Laura Bush's case, the big spoiler is 9/11 happened. So it's like, so it's hard to protect yourself from that. But basically, let me tell you a little bit about her. So she's like a Texan woman. She's the exact same age as her husband, which I really enjoy. I like it when people are the same age as their spouses. And like, from the absolute up top of this whole segment, I want to say, I think like George Bush is probably one of the most, I don't know that much about like American politics as a non-American, but like a hideous president, like terrible.
Very, very, very stupid.
Yeah. And like, just like, people sort of even like George Bush apologists are like, he was basically too stupid to have known any better.
Yeah.
And he was like a puppet for this, like this Republican government. But like the Patriot Act, you know, invading Iraq, like everything, it's all bad. But I think what I always find really fascinating with people I don't like is when they have really strong marriages.
Yes.
Because it's like a thing that you associate with like good people, like people who are able to have like loving spouses who like clearly it's not an act. It's like a real thing, you know?
Yeah, because with someone like that, you're always like, oh, well, they must just be evil together. They must just talk about evil things together and like go and shoot wildlife and stuff.
Totally. They must just be evil together. And Hannah, I'm so glad that you said this because that leads me into the biggest point of this. It's just that like until she married her husband, she was a Democrat.
No.
What? Yeah,
she was a Democrat. She was a primary school teacher. She had a master's in library science. She was a librarian. She purposefully went out of her way to like work in really poor schools. Like,
excuse me? She was Miss Honey.
She was Oh my God. She was Miss Honey.
This is blowing my... Because I've always been really suspicious. You know what you're saying about having a good marriage? I hate the fact that the Obamas are really good friends with the Bushes. And I'm like, what do they know that we don't? But maybe they just love Barbara.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? I think, like, if you totally divorce the Bushes from everything terrible they've done...
Sure.
I think they're good. They're, like, good crack. Like,
fair.
That's an awful thing to say, and I'm sure many people won't like me because of it, but like I think you can separate someone doing evil things from being good crack. And I think Trump has been coasting on that for years. Like people, like I've met journalists who have like been in rooms with him and he's like, yeah, I've like been at benefits he's hosted for years and he's always lovely. Like, and it's, I just think that is, it's one of the central, most compelling things about being a human being is like how you can just hold all those complexities. But to get back to Laura, so she's born in Texas in this like kind of small-ish city of about 100,000 people called, I think, Midland or something, Midland, Texas. And a very sort of like middle-class family. She's the only child of her parents and has a very like, is very pretty, is very popular, has a very like 1950s childhood. And then 2 weeks after her 17th birthday in November 1963, she is out driving with her pal under the speed limit. She's going to like a movie theater, a drive-in. She's there with her pal. She doesn't see a stop sign and she kills one of her best friends who's in another car.
Who's in another car?
Literally, she plows through another car and it happens to be the car of her best friend and she kills him instantly.
And, like, oh my God.
And weirdly, his name is Michael Douglas.
Obviously, what is happening?
It's a really like tragic thing, but I just think it's really weird that his name is Michael Douglas. But like he was literally like they were in this like big group at school. They were all like very popular and athletic. He was going out with her best mate. She was really good friends with him. Like they'd grown up together. They like would spend hours on the phone together and stuff. Like he was a properly a good friend of hers and going out with her best friend. And she killed him instantly 2 weeks before Kennedy was assassinated, which is kind of just a historical note. And like, so just like, what does that do to a person? Do you know what I mean? Especially in this like quite small city and like, it's kind of a spoiler for this book that I'm reading by Curtis Sittenfeld, American Wife. Like a lot of it is about that and how it just Sittenfeld kind of wondering like, how does that change a person?
But, it changed her by making her want to marry a Republican.
Yeah. And so like all of her biographers say like, you know, she was an extremely like thoughtful person and she like always thought really hard before she did anything. And she kind of really wanted to live her life in service to other people. And it all happened because of this car crash. Wow. And like, she told her biographers that she's lived with the guilt her entire life. She never went to the funeral and she never visited the boy's parents afterwards. Oh. And she always regretted it because like nobody knew how to handle the situation. It was all just very weird. And like, they kind of tried to carry on as if life was normal, but life was just never normal again.
Oh my God, that would ruin your life.
It would ruin your fucking life. Like, one of your pals as well. Like, and like...
So maybe that's the thing. Maybe she thought, well, if I marry someone who's able to change things, I can make life better for people.
Well, maybe, because like, she doesn't really talk. She's quite a private person, and like, so she went and she got like a master's in library science, became a librarian, and it became Miss Honey, right? And she, yeah. And like, considering now this is the 70s and in Texas, like quite a conservative society, like by the time she's 31 years old, she's unmarried, like, and she's like, look up the pictures of her. She's a gorgeous woman, like, and like, it was very odd for like her and her friends and her family that like Laura is still unmarried at the age of 31 and all she cares about is like teaching underprivileged kids and being Miss Honey. And yeah, like, yeah. Then she meets George Bush at this like barbecue, a friend of a friend, and like he's 31 as well.
And I imagine still in the ninth grade. Is that how she met him? She was teaching him.
She was teaching him to read. Wow. My biggest underprivileged child of all, George W. Bush.
I can fix him.
I can fix him. Maybe he can move things with his mind like Matilda. And here's the thing. So like somebody who like has lived her whole life in this very like politically liberal, but like personally conservative way. Like she's very quiet and thoughtful. Then she like they meet at this barbecue. They go mini golfing on their first date and they're married 3 months later.
Wow.
Ooh. And like her wedding dress, I think I sent you guys a picture of her, of them on their wedding day earlier on, because I've been looking at their pictures all day. Like, I want one of you to open the picture I sent you and describe what it is that you see.
Yeah, it's basically something that you'd think would be the wedding dress now of like a cool literary woman that you knew, who just like decided to get married a couple of days before and like went to Zara and got a really cool dress.
Yes,
that is exactly what it is. Like, it's like very simple. It's kind of like a pearly color. Like, and then she's there, and like her and George are there, and they look like such a handsome, nice couple.
Yeah, George Bush actually looks like a bit of a ride here.
I know, it's mad. We will post this on social, and like then it's like his parents are flanking them on either side, and obviously his parents are George Bush and Barbara Bush. And at that point, George Bush Sr. wasn't like famous yet. Or he wasn't like a president yet, obviously. But
right,
like,
I was going to say, what stage was he at, kind of thing?
That wasn't until the 80s, but they were still millionaires. Like they were like, they had this like huge Bush compound in Texas. They like were oil millionaires. Like they were like absolutely filthy rich. And there's Laura. Laura just buys this dress, this beigey grey dress off the rack, like a few days before she gets married, and like meets, and that's how she like enters into the hyper rich world of her new husband. Like, wow. It's kind of great, right?
Yeah, and she's not from money or anything.
She's like middle class.
Wow.
I wonder what her motivation was with that. Like, was it just, you know, oh, I like this guy and I'll marry him, great, or was it like, yeah, I'll marry into this rich family and then sort of, you know, see what I can do with it.
Well, apparently, like, it was like a total whirlwind romance. And they were just genuinely, like, really mad about each other. And I know, it's so weird. It's like, wow, this guy who's responsible for so many awful things.
Yeah.
He obviously, like, he was politically motivated even then. But she said to him, like, I'll only marry you if you promise that you'll never make me do a campaign speech and you'll never, like, drag me into your world or make me be some kind of mouthpiece for the Republican Party.
Wow.
So she was still a Democrat then? Like, I don't know why I feel like, you know, if you marry someone who's Muslim, sometimes you have to, like, convert to Islam. For some reason, I've got that in my head that she would have to, like, renounce being a Democrat.
That's exactly what I'm picturing as well.
Yeah, you would think, because I think as well, because maybe even like 30 years ago, this wouldn't have been that strange. I don't know. But it feels like today, because people are so political and so polarized. I just have people all the time. And I obviously haven't dated in a long time. But like, oh, I'd never date a Tory. I'd never date someone who thought this. I never, like, people's ideals are like extremely important to them now. And like, and maybe they were then too. I can't say. But like, I don't think any of my friends would, like, openly date a Tory.
No, I would find it really difficult, yeah, to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, like, I'm not saying that either one is a choice or not. I think, like, you know, marry who you're in love with and try and influence them as much as you can, like,
yeah,
truly.
But, bring them down from the inside.
break them down from the inside. And this was actually, once she became the first lady, like, because all, like, so many liberals recognized that she was such a smart person, she was so well read, like, she, like, was always kind of like inviting these really prominent authors and speakers to the White House, and she was trying to make it as learned as possible. And like, what all her critics have said was like, she's obviously a smart woman and she's standing there and she's doing nothing. And she's like letting all these terrible things happen. And like, she even said in her memoir, she was like, she says she believes in gay marriage, and like, her husband acted against gay marriage at every count. She said she believes that abortion is a fundamental female healthcare right. And her husband tried to roll back abortion rights as well. Like, it's mad.
I'd be so interested to be a fly on the wall in that marriage when those conversations were happening.
Yeah. I don't know how you can marry the two, you know, like the ideals and the man, because I just think I would be, my wide on would be absolutely gone if my boyfriend was like, oh, obviously I don't believe in abortion and gay marriage. No. I'd be like, oh, I don't think I can see you as a sexual being anymore. I would find that really off-putting.
It's really weird. And it's like, I suppose everyone always says about like the Trump presidency that like, actually there's loads of terrible things that he wants to do, but we never hear about it because Ivanka is really good at like reeling him in, and that she's actually quite liberal. That's what people say. But like, you'd wonder if with Laura Bush, it was the same thing that like...
Isn't Ivanka the daughter?
Yeah, I mean,
the daughter
Ivanka
wife.
Kind of like, yeah, she is the daughter wife, which is fucking weird. But she has like a lot of sway. But when she was promoted, when Laura Bush was promoting her memoir, which kind of said that she believed in both abortion and gay marriage, Larry King was like, what the fuck? Like, how can you believe in these things and also, you know, your husband doesn't? And she just said, you know, he understands my view and I understand his, and it's, you know, it's not a thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
But just like everything you read about this woman, she's so like, she so stays out of the limelight, and it's weird because she was sandwiched between these two really outgoing first ladies. Like, if you think of Hillary Clinton before her and Michelle Obama after her, like, they're,
of course, yeah,
like two like hugely forceful personalities. And then there's her in the middle, just like, quietly like doing her thing, you know,
just like quietly voting against her husband.
And there's a story that like someone tells about her, where it's like, so there was this whole thing when Bush got elected for the second time, where there was suspicion of him having rigged the ballot and of it being a completely bogus election, and and so it went to like to Congress for like weeks, where like they were debating whether or not he was, they were trying to figure it out, basically, whether or not he had cheated in his election. But she, meanwhile, was like hosting some kind of like book event. And like, literally on the day that he was getting the referendum on, as to whether or not he could become president, she was like, someone talks about her like literally like being at this stall, like asking how many tote bags were sold. Like, she's just like somebody who like takes her responsibilities like very seriously. And like, has always been really committed to like books and literacy and education in a way that like, I think with a lot of first ladies, there's this kind of thing to be like, I care about everything that's like related to like women and like, you know, food and kids and like everything that isn't specifically about the presidency. Yeah. And, like, where she's like, no, I care about literacy and like, I care about kids reading and I care about it with my whole heart all the time.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really fascinating.
If I'm trying to find a tiny silver lining about George Bush Jr., it's that, fair enough that he didn't try and make her, you know, a part of his appeal or a part of his campaign, where he had this like angel woman that's sitting there.
Yeah.
And at least he wasn't like, oh, actually, you have to give up your life to become part of mine. It sounds like she actually did just carry on with doing her own thing.
Yeah, like, I find it really like fascinating. And also, when you think about, she is the only first lady in history to have a first lady for a mother-in-law.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes, meta.
So weird. Like, so I imagine it's so strange to have like that example before you. Like, because nobody would have been like, oh, I don't know, we're all just making this up as we go along, because the Bushes like knew. They knew how to do things by then.
Yeah.
That must be so weird for Barbara to be seeing her son follow exactly in the footsteps of her husband and then to get this, yeah, daughter-in-law and just be like, well, she's me.
Yeah, right? And like this whole thing of like, well, when mom was first lady, she always put out cookies for the Democrats or whatever.
That's not know? How she baked the cakes for the bake sale, okay?
So weird. And like, I saw this thing about like when it was about, because every first lady obviously puts her little stamp on the White House, you know? And and Laura Bush's little stamp was that she organized all the books by the Dewey Decimal System.
Oh,
and then Trump probably just burnt all the books when he arrived.
Yeah.
Burn them all.
Oh, God. I feel like she sounds like she has a brain. And without being too cruel, I mean, it really, really seems like George Bush Jr. really didn't. I mean, how?
Yeah, I don't really get it. But everyone who's ever seen them together has been like, they are like literally like, the wind beneath each other's wings. It's like he's like quite jokey and silly and outgoing, and she's quite retired and thoughtful. And just together, they just love each other and get a real kick out of each other.
Wow.
And I want to say it again. I don't like the Bushes. But I really, and hats off to Curtis Sittenfeld. And like, everybody read the book because it is as good as everybody says it is. And it's the perfect length for like, you know, Corona reading, which is 450 pages long.
Yeah, yeah.
I also just find, this is like very shallow, I just find her really pretty. Like,
aww.
She's just like, she's just that kind of woman. She's how you want to look when you're in your 70s. Like, she has this like, very beautiful face with these lovely green eyes. And I like looking at her.
Oh, I'm looking at her now. She looks nice.
What's she doing these days? Is she like on Twitter or something? Is she active or are they kind of just retired?
She's on Instagram and she likes animals, you know? So, fine. Which is a very retired first lady thing to be into, is animals.
Do you know what's so weird as well? Is like I said with the Man of Two Swords thing, like Laura Bush is in a pandemic right now.
Yeah.
What she's doing?
I wonder.
Same with her animals, doing. Probably.
With her animals.
Probably, yeah. Like, teaching George Bush how to add.
Yeah. Today, George, we're doing fractions.
Yeah.
Now, if we have 10 cupcakes and we take away 5.
What did I tell you about washing your hands? Come on, George.
Let's sing the happy birthday song together while we wash our hands.
It's time for our smart lesson, in which we try to learn more about how to become smart feminist women. Alex, you're talking about being horny today.
That's right, Hannah. My smart lesson this week is how to be horny. Of course, very difficult in these current times if you are single and or not living with your significant other or anyone you can sleep with. So it's, you know, it's testing times, especially for myself. I mean, you both live with your partners, so I assume you're having sex every 7 minutes, is that correct?
Well, my boyfriend has decided to go and get something called COVID, so there's been lots of washing up gloves around the place at the moment, although what's new, you know?
Oh, COVID. I think I've seen something about that on the news, but I can't be sure.
Yeah, I think Eamon Holmes did a segment on it or something.
And 5G.
Yes, 5G strings. Sorry, I'm just getting in the mood of a horny person because it was also National Horny Day last week. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
There's now a National Horny Day.
How does National Horny Day differentiate from all of the other days in my life?
That was exactly one of the main questions I thought about, but as yet, no answer from the government. Apparently they're tied up with some other stuff. So I feel like it didn't get the recognition it deserves. And, you know, everyone's in a different scenario here. And I think I can speak for all single people where when I say that dating apps are awful because I hate them anyway. And even if you're trying to make a connection with someone on there, and even if you do, you sort of have to be like, right, well, see you in 2 months, maybe, I guess.
Yeah, such an odd one, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's quite a strange one. So what I would say is match with everyone you want on an app. This is my smart lesson tip. Then send them a sort of generic message and just say, message me on the 1st of June. And then you can sort of pick up where you left off. You know, you've got them there, you've got the match, you've planted the seed. But let's not waste 6 weeks of time getting to know each other in case we meet each other in person and are, you know, appalled.
Yeah. It's very like Sleepless in Seattle and Meet Me at the Top of the Empire State Building, except for every single person you match with on Hinge.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Some people have got back in touch with their ex because, you know, you can't see them, so you may as well just enjoy the fun stuff.
See, I'm very offended. I keep hearing about people who keep hearing from their exes, and not a single one of my exes has gotten in touch. Like, I'm horny. I mean, I know I'm having sex with my live-in boyfriend, but I could still use a dick pic from someone I haven't seen since 2008.
Well, there you go. You've said it on here. I'm sure you'll be absolutely inundated now. I think the rule of the smart lesson is basically, you know, during this pandemic, there are no rules, okay? I don't think you're not able to cheat. Like, Caroline, if you enjoyed a dick pic from anyone, Gavin would have to be fine with it, you know, because it's not your fault. Everybody is extremely horny. If you want to pretend you're having more sex than you are, maybe tweet or Instagram pictures of your cranberry sachets and say you've got cystitis, you know.
People will instantly think
that you're being rogered every minute of every day.
Yeah, and as well, you're creating scarcity, which will create demand.
Yes, exactly.
My tip for this is if you are a person who's having sex, you have to theme your sex nights. So,
okay, I'm listening.
So me and Gavin, we have workshop Tuesdays. So Tuesdays is when you workshop a new idea. And then Sunday.
I thought it was like he was a carpenter in a workshop.
No, it's when you get to bring whatever you want to the ideas table and nobody gets to judge or comment on it later and make fun of them over dinner.
That's fine.
Workshop Tuesdays. And then Sunday is trad night.
Oh, lovely. Well, just like the sort of what, you know, what works.
Nope. Yeah. Proper, no, 1950s, like missionary all the way.
Cracking. That's what you want on a Sunday night, to be fair. You don't want to be bringing out the toys and the masks and the role play, you know?
Yeah. You want to be made love to like he's about to go to Vietnam, you know?
Yes, exactly. You want the last of the summer wine sex on a Sunday. You cannot be having...
So glad no one listens to this podcast.
That's like my friend once texted me on a Wednesday morning saying that she was driving to work and she had a bit of... ejaculate in her hair that she'd forgotten to get out, and my boyfriend of the time was like, oh my god, that's awful. And I was like, well, you know, she didn't mean for it to be in there. And he went, no, it's just that he shouldn't be coming on her face on a Tuesday night. And I was like, sorry, when is acceptable for the face jizz? Just give me a timetable.
On a Tuesday. I am obsessed with that.
And then I thought about it and I was like, I see what you mean. I mean, it's, you know, it's midweek.
Really more of a birthday treat.
Yes, exactly. FaceTime sex. I mean, you know, if you're having some sexy time over the phone, generally, you know, can be quite horny, but obviously it's like an online comedy gig. There's not a lot of atmosphere, okay? And also you've got to think about angles. Like, remember when you switch your phone on sometimes and it's, you know, facing your face and you look like a thumb?
Oh my god, it's like you have six chins. Awful.
Even worse if you're trying to make someone else horny. Okay. So just
totally.
Beware.
Yeah, it can't be live streaming while you flip it around because you would look like your own granddad. No, no, no.
But you know, also take the time to dress up over FaceTime. You know, characters, role, you've got a lot of time to just put into some new looks. I've got a lot of wigs, you know. Maybe if you own any of them, get them out.
The thing about dressing up for any kind of FaceTime, whether it's a sex call or a business call or whatever, is that it's that same thing about, like, you know, when you watch porn and then after you're like done, it's still there. It's like after the call is over, you're still just sitting there in your pants and your wig. And being like, well, now I feel dumb.
Yes. Yes. Horrendous. If you're single, order yourself some sexy underwear because we're still allowed to use online delivery services. Take some absolutely incredible nudes, send them to every single person you've previously slept with, followed quickly by a, oh, so sorry, didn't mean to send this to you. Hope you're well.
Hope you're doing well in these unprecedented times here on my
And just, you know, see what happens. But I also saw, Caroline, I want you to help people that are in a long-term relationship. I saw that you had started using your Google Calendar to schedule sex, and I'm intrigued by it. Have you got any tips for the listeners?
Well, yes. So both Gavin and I are working from home, and at different kind of ends of our incredibly small flat. And I thought it would be cute and sweet and a little sexy of me if I just, like, you know, put a little event in his diary that was like, nice. Oh, and I always, like, had, like, a cute, like, office friendly line in the event description, like, oh, nice. a chance for everyone to come share what they did with the team. Office lingo, and I kept putting them in his diary, like, and he tentatively accepted, and I was like, tentatively wow. accept,
wow.
And then I got a notification, and this is like, he didn't even like call across the flat saying, haha, funny joke, babe. He pretty tentatively accepted, and then a minute later, he deleted it from his calendar. I was like, fuck you. I'm trying to make things special for us.
That is, I would find that extremely horny, Caroline. If you were my girlfriend, I'd be like, yes, please.
Aww.
I am accepting this meeting.
I love a parallel world where you and I are girlfriends.
Yes, but your career would immediately tank because we'd be having sex all the time.
I know. We'd both be so needy, is the thing.
So needy. My final don't is just simply one line. Under no circumstances, meet the one during these times, because by the time you actually meet them, you will hate them. So that's my tip for you all. Just don't find any true happiness.
Oh, great. Love to end on a positive note.
No worries. Anytime, guys. I'm here for you all.
And that's all for this week. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, you can hear more by searching School for Dumb Women on your favourite podcast app and following us on the usual social media platforms at Dumb Women Pod. You can also hear us on Soho Radio every other Thursday at 6 p.m. Thanks to Gavin Day for our artwork, Harry Harris for our jingles, and Soho Radio Studios for helping us with the remote recording. Stay safe, everybody, and stay dumb. Bye!
Bye!
And I will see the rest of you on Trad Night.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.